welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. You just heard a little bit of a song called Animal Eyes by the No Tomorrow Boys. This week's edition of Books and Booze is once again brought to you by the Booked Anthology. This is Renee. I'm having a Boddington's, and we happen to be here with somebody who is featured in the Booked Anthology. Didn't even happen on purpose. One of our readers from Books and Booze live in St. Louis, author of The Samaritan, Fred Venerini. How are you doing, and what are you drinking?
Doing excellent. I am drinking in St. Louis tradition. I'm a bit of a boo for me, but it'll do. It hydrates you after.
So, Jessica, did you get your Blue Moon, or are you still drinking whatever it was you were drinking in the pre-show meeting?
I got my Blue Moon, so all is right with the world.
All right. I get scared when you don't have your Blue Moon.
I know.
It upsets the universe.
Dakota, what are you drinking? Or should I ask what you're pretending to drink first? I don't know anymore.
I'm actually running out of fake drinks. So, well, yeah. Have I used Pepto-Bismol and 151?
My fake drink? Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm going to go with that. Yeah, one chases the other quite nice.
I'm going to go with that.
But I'm actually drinking a 7-7, so I'm actually halfway fancy tonight as opposed to my usual drinks.
You're actually having a real mixed drink as opposed to one you just made up.
Yeah, I make them very, very strong, though. So.
Well, that's
waging
good.
War on my liver.
Well, I like the concept of a drink that features Pepto-Bismol. I mean, I just glad the multitask.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. It could be good. I'm not like taste good, but it could be good for you. Really,
I want to say it would make you throw up, but I don't know.
So, market then.
What?
I'll trademark it. 151 and Pepto, and I'll let you know how it goes.
You can call it Pink Fireball. Oh, call it Pink Fireball.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm writing that down right now.
Problem solving. We do.
So, Fred, you're in the Booked Anthology. It's out now.
Yes.
You want to, pump up your story that's in there a little bit? I haven't got my hands on it yet, so.
Well, that story is called The Pound of Flesh. It's kind of near and dear to me. I've always enjoyed it because of the backstory of the story itself, because that's the one that just kind of happened when my wife asked me, why can't you write a love story? So I started to write a love story, and then I got stuck, and I was like, how can I really have this couple prove that they love each other? And then I was like, oh, I'll just have somebody show up at their house and force them to torture each other. That sounds great. So I tried that
lovely.
Out. And, So I tried that out. I actually was doing my MFA at the time, so I workshopped that particular story. And I'll never forget this. Michael Nye, my instructor, he's actually managing editor at the Missouri Review now. But he puts in the notes, he says, never thought I'd say this, but more torture. So, I took that to heart. I rewrote the story, and it turned out to be really, really long. I never thought I'd get it published, especially after there was a whole glut of, home invasion movies, like The Strangers came out, and, of course, the Straw Dogs remake and stuff, and I had never even seen the original. So it just kind of sat on the back burner there, but I always knew I wanted to give it to somebody, so... what actually happened was Jedediah Ayers, who was doing the Noir at the Bar anthology, the second installment, said, do you have a story for us? I gave him two, and I said, pick one. I'm not really generating a whole lot of new short stories now, but I think that this would fit what you're looking for, so take a look. Well, I gave him A Pound of Flesh and another one called The Low Man. So he ended up picking The Low Man, but I guess in one of the, I think it was like a PDF he was giving to some trusted readers or something, but there was a copy of it floating around with A Pound of Flesh in there. So the Book Podcast size guys got a hold of it, and I was on the show and was like, hey, can we have that story for our anthology? I was like, fantastic, I can't wait. I've always wanted to see that one in print. I'm really glad it's out there, especially in the leadoff spot. It's kind of cool to go first with all those amazing authors coming after you, because as I've said before, whether it's first in a reading or first in an anthology, you can always say, I did the best so far.
So speaking of stories within stories, Jessica mentioned this for anybody who's watched the videos we have out currently of our event in St. Louis. You heard this. The way that you broke into the literary scene was a little bit different than most people. And so I was hoping that maybe you could kind of humor us that story, because it's kind of cool. It's like a fairy tale.
I've got a lot of my writer friends who are just very frank and like, what kind of deal with the devil did you make? You know, what virgin did you sacrifice to get some of the shit that's happened to you to happen? And it's just, I think I'm just really, really lucky because I don't think I'm a grinder when it comes to writing. I really wish I was. I enjoy it. It's always been a hobby of me, something I like to do, for as long as I can remember. Since I was a little kid, writing my own novelizations of Dragon Warrior for Nintendo, I was always writing stories and doing stuff, but I've just never been that grinder guy that's going to get that manuscript and polish it up and send it out and do all this stuff. I'm just kind of a lollygagger sometimes. So when doing my MFA, you make a lot of connections, do a lot of networking that way, and it forced me to write a lot. So, that was great. And I had a short story that was basically a really, really condensed version of The Samaritan. And the thing with that short story was all the feedback I got from the MFA group was basically, look, it's all a summary. Why don't you make this no longer work? There's a lot there. And I was like, there's another novel to go after. Maybe I'll do that. So I was inspired to really do that. So I'm working on it, and my MFA is over. And I think it was just one of those through the grapevine things. One of my classmates, Mackenzie, she was friends with Christy McKenzie, who opened up Blank Slate Press, which is an indie publisher in St. Louis. And Nancy told Christy, hey, let me check with this guy from my MFA class. He's working on a book. He's good. And it's like they were fielding applications for writers, and I didn't even know they existed. And all of a sudden I come on the email, and it's like, here's about this, application, let's see a sample of your work and stuff. And I was like, this sounds great, I'm going to do this. So I think it was a pretty big field of authors had really tried to get into that. We could never really write a book. It was actually kind of a risk when you think about it that way. And when they asked me, when they saw another my manuscript, and they made me an offer before I was even done with it to be like their first book, even I was like, man, is this for real? I bounced that idea off of authors and stuff, and I would say it was 50-50. Half of them said, don't answer with a 10-foot pole. Just wait, just finish it, and do it the traditional way. And half of them said, it's a new world, man. Get your stuff out there. If you build it, it'll come. Actually, me internally, I was always leaning towards signing it and getting it done and going that route. But the people that I had talked to, because I, don't know a ton about the business, actually, especially at that point. The people I had talked to were pretty split, A lot of them, they were either on one side of the fence or the other. There was really no, I don't know. It was either like, oh, yeah, definitely go for it, or, I don't know about that, Fred. Just finish your book and do it the old-fashioned way and see how that goes. But eventually, especially after meeting Christy and all the folks at Blank Slate Press and everything, I knew that, they're in my backyard. This is going to give me a chance to see if I'm any good or not, because at that point I definitely didn't know if I was at all. I think that every writer has a little bit of a, I think they have a mix of overconfidence and underconfidence at the same time, depending on what you ask them about or what kind of day they're having.
Absolutely.
So yeah, eventually I just decided, okay, I'm going to give you guys this manuscript, let's get to work, and I'll finish it up and we'll see how it goes. So I think even that was kind of a different thing for a first-time author, to have a manuscript in progress and sell it. Even though it's an indie publisher, I
I didn't think that that really happened. And a lot of people told me that that doesn't really happen.
Yeah.
And then, timeline-wise, yeah, finished up the book, and they put it out, and I couldn't have been more pleased with the experience, with the feedback, with the response. I mean, I was kind of just blown away by it. And as that went along, and the sales were pretty good, and there was good turnouts at the readings, and everybody in my area rallied around me and stuff. And then what happened was it made the USA Today. Like,
wow.
They had a top 10 novels, top 10 independent novels of the year or something like that. So it was like, wow, USA Today, you know, that's the USA Today. That's pretty cool. I've never been in the USA Today before. And that is when the agent started calling. So I was, you know, basically unrepresented, and I was told, you know, maybe you should flash this blank slate press contract to an agent. This would be an easy way to leverage getting an agent. But I didn't even know where to start. So I just, you know, I signed the contract and just went with them. And when the agent started calling, I mean, there were some serious agencies calling. So I think I had four total. And I won't list them all or anything because I don't know if disclosure, I don't know if that's tasteful to do, but I ended up going with William Morris Endeavor, WME, who, that's an agency. You're like, are you serious? I mean, if you're going
to
shortlist a bunch of agencies, WME is one of them because I like that they had reach into different kinds of media. You know, they have clients that do all kinds of stuff. You know, for example, I have Kirby, my literary agent, but I talked to two other agents about movies and TV rights specifically. They handle that all their own. So then it's like, oh, my goodness, WME just knocks on your door and plucks you off the tree. And his whole strategy was, I think that we can take this book and we can repackage this and we can rebrand this and there's a bigger audience for it. There's a bigger deal out there for it. So, and it took a while, because Blank Slate Press, of course, had certain rights and everything like that. So there was paperwork and things of that nature. But eventually I jumped ship from Blank Slate Press, who I still have a great relationship with, and support them and love them very much.
Great.
But, yeah, represented by WME, and we redid the manuscript, and I had great feedback and redid it, and all of a sudden here I am with a shiny new book deal. So... kind of a lucky guy, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty intense. And then it leads me, we started to answer this, but it leads me to Gordon's question, which after reading the book myself, the original, I am interested in this myself. He says he would like to know about the difference in your experiences between the two novel publishers. And what goes into rebooting a book that some say needn't be fucked with?
Yeah, you know, and that's an excellent question. And it's a question I get a lot because I think that any time you say, oh, I'm rewriting my book, there can be a perception, oh, you think the old version is shitty and you think you're going to make it better. But let me tell you how this process actually went down. And I don't want anybody to get the perception that a publisher or an agent cracked the whip, and I was like, yeah, I'll redo it. The way that it actually went down was he showed the book around as it was, and what's great about WME is there was a lot of phone calls with a lot of editors from a lot of big publishers that were interested, but they didn't want the book as it stood. But nobody really said to me, and I think this is kind of unheard of too, if you have some big six editors on the phone that don't want your book but they want to talk to you about your writing. I don't think that happens too often, especially for a first-time author. So I took full advantage of those particular calls. And the way it was presented to me was, you know, we can't really do this book as it stands. It's just not quite there. And they had their issues with it. And basically it was posed to me, if you had a chance to revisit this, what are your ideas? What do you think, you know, might be improved upon? What do you think would be different now than when you wrote it, you know, which is basically like 5 years ago I started it now. And I told him because I think it's rare for a writer to be able to revisit their work. And I, after it was out and everything, I daydream a lot, and I had thought of, man, I could have done this with the ending, and I could have done this with a twist. And the big difference was in 2008, when I started it, really, I was a different guy. You know, I was 28. I didn't have a kid. I think I really was more nihilistic, writing a lot of darker fiction. you know, really some of the horror stories are really aggressive and stuff. And I think that when I took the version that you guys, you know, have read and I revisited it, I noticed that with the main character, it was just a steady downward plane, and there were very few instances where he got that taste of hope that you really need to make it a bumpier ride for the reader. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to give the main character a little more, a few more tastes of hope, you know, more of an up and down ride. And of course, I also wanted to frame up a new ending that I, you know, I wish I'd have thought of back when I was finishing the manuscript the first time. And there was a twist that was there the whole time that I never really executed because I didn't know it was there to be executed. So I took a shot at that too. And the feedback and the editorial experience that I had with my agent and with people and, you know, with beta readers and stuff was really amazing. And I was really proud of the new version of the book. So the way that I view it is the Samaritan is the 28-year-old Fred. That's like the director's cut. That's the hardcore cut. And this thing's going to be something new entirely.
Is it going to have a different name?
Yes. And to top off the rebranding, I actually brought this up. I said, you know, we've done so much work on this. I'm totally open to doing a new title, especially since the Samaritan has kind of saturated the landscape a little bit. There's a Sam Jackson movie out, and I think another couple of novels are out. And it really, if I came up with the same title, it just kind of attaches me to that old book that's going to come up on all the Google results and the Amazon page and stuff. So we came up with a new title, and the title is The Heart Does Not Grow Back. So that is what's coming out
like
next
that.
Fall.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to tell you that one of the hardest things about doing this show is when I have a question that I really want the answer to, but I can't ask it because it's going to be too spoiler heavy. So I need you to promise me that after the show, you'll message me on Facebook and just give me an idea about what's going to change about the ending. Don't tell me, because I'll read it. But just give me an idea.
Well, you know what's crazy is right now, you know, I feel like the manuscript is finished. But, of course, I just got an email from Ficador's editorial today, and we're going to start editorial on the new manuscript for probably the next 3 months. We're going to go through and do even more stuff. So, and I've already talked at length with them. And it was actually the first time that I had offered some resistance to suggestions. You know, a few of them, I said, you know, I had considered that, and here's why I don't think that's the way to go. So I at least felt good doing that. I didn't want to be a yes man about it, but there was one or two things. I was like, you know, all that takes is a line here, a passage there, maybe in, you know, maybe slip in a new chapter. There's room to grow here. It still stayed around 73,000 to 78,000 words. So there is a little bit of room to grow, but I think that's still the sweet spot for it.
Yeah.
So, before I ask this question, I want to remind you that you told us that there was no questions you could think of that I wasn't allowed to ask.
Right.
Jessica mentioned something about a possible TV deal that had some connection to somebody who works on Supernatural.
You know, and here's the other thing. As an excited, I'm not going to say young, you know, I am 33, but as an excited first-time author, when I get good news and stuff, I like to share it. You know, I've thrown it out on Facebook and stuff, even though it's probably premature and I'll look silly if nothing really happens from it, but the chances of a TV show really happening, you know, who knows what the odds really are. So I'm just going to try and take advantage of all the good news and the good momentum while I can. And the first good news I had was that Joel McHale has a production company, and they want to do the TV series. They love the book. And this is the old Samaritan. It's like, oh, there's got to be a TV series. They have a first-look deal with Sony. So the nice thing about WME is they do packaging. You know, they can line up talent to kind of get these things going. So it's been a long ride, but eventually, you know, the step was, hey, now we got to find a writer. So the last I've heard is that a writer who works on Supernatural, and I think he's going to be an executive producer on that show this year. His name is Dan Laughlin. The last I heard, he loved the book, and he's writing, you know, concepts related to the TV adaptation of that particular book. So, of course, I tell my TV agent, hey, you know, there's a new manuscript rolling out there, so make sure they get a look at that and stuff like that. So it's nice to have irons in the fire, and, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say I was super excited and really pumped at the potential you know, I just want there to be a pilot film because I just want to go.
Yeah.
I just want to go. If there's a pilot film, even if it just tanks and no one ever sees it, I just like, oh, I got to take this picture at this pilot. This is my work. This is crazy. So yeah, it's really quite a trip, but that's kind of where it stands right now. And it's a slow burn in that particular side of the industry, I suppose. And there's seasons and certain times that you can pitch ideas and stuff. And I can't really
right.
keep track of all that, but I'm always hoping for that phone call that says something else is going on. It's always nice when you get that phone call from an area code. You're like, oop, agent, what's up?
What
I wouldn't know anything about
around?
That.
Oh,
one of the things floating around was that Quentin Tarantino read this book as, I guess, one of the agents sent it to him, possibly.
Well, there's a few people, I think, that have read the book that enjoyed it but weren't going to necessarily progress it on the movie side of things. That's another nice thing with an agency with this type of reach. And it's they kind of just – you're in the conversation – and they throw it off like first name. Like, you know, oh, Guillermo read this, or Quentin read this, you know, and it's like, wait, hold up 1 second. Let me just rewind this 1 second. He actually read the book? Do we have proof that he read it? I really don't have proof that he read it. You never know. I could be getting some smoke blowing up my ass.
You have a video of
maybe,
him sitting in bed reading the book, because that's what I need.
Maybe he just read the back of it and said, oh, that sounds cool, fuck this guy. You really don't know. But in the context of the conversation, I'm always stopping. So I'm stopping like, whoa, wait a second. Did this person actually read? Because I'm, you know, she's interested in a deal. She's interested in progress. And I'm just interested in, like, these people actually read this thing? You just hated it.
I was
like, he read my book.
I kind of hate you right now. Look,
so,
any of you.
I get that a lot.
If you want me to to not hate you, I need two things from you. Two promises.
Oh, no. Don't agree.
If you become like BFFs with the people who work on Supernatural, like you're inviting me to that party. And if you become like BFFs with Quentin Tarantino, you're inviting me to that party. And then,
well,
and then we'll be cool.
There's no way I'm going to be a BFF with Quentin Tarantino, and I've actually never even seen an episode of Supernatural. Did not even know it existed. I had to Google. I was like, Supernatural, what's this? You know, and it, you know, at least it seems to be a popular show. No idea that it had the reach that it did. And,
I'm like borderline obsessed with it. Like, because I see people who are
borderline.
Really obsessed
She's
with
like
it.
Fully.
Yeah, but okay. But when you go online and you look at like some of the people who are like genuinely like they like live inside their TVs. Like, I'm not quite there. But me and my husband love that show. So.
Like,
well, I mentioned it in front of my nieces, and they went crazy. They even knew all the writers and stuff. So.
And I assume your nieces are not 29.
Oh, no.
Okay, so a follow-up to that, is somebody, you were kind enough to ask for input on your own Facebook page. Usually all of our questions come from listeners that participate in the group. But you had some friends ask some questions, and Josh Wood asked, who would you ideally cast to play these characters if you could get anybody?
Yeah, and a thing about Josh, brilliant guy. I don't know if anybody has him on Facebook or anything. Really smart guy, teaches writing, unbelievable writer, just a great guy. And it doesn't surprise me that he asked basically the only really insightful question on that particular thread comes from Josh. So if you haven't checked him out, he has one story that I really love. It's called Jesus versus Thor. So that right there. And I was still alone. I was in. I was like, all right, man, let's check this out. So what a story that was. He did that old school biblical. It was hardcore. But with that said, One of the things that I do when I write, I actually cast the characters while I'm working or before I'm working. And I don't think this is particularly unique. I think that a lot of writers might throw up a picture. You know what I mean? Just to kind of...
Sure.
Especially if you're changing points of view, you know, to kind of get
yeah.
the vibe and everything. So I actually do, I kind of cast the quote-unquote movie before or during while I'm working once I get a feel for the character. And I also, this is this might be unique. This might be unique to me. I don't know how many people are obsessed with like trailer music and movie scores, and I like assign each one of them to characters and moods. Especially
wow.
Hans Zimmer. Hans Zimmer's my guy. Like the Samaritan rewrite was so totally Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises score. That was the whole rewrite. So, but as for the Samaritan, the number one casting choice that I have and the most solid one, the one I feel the best about, is Doc Venhaus would be Bryan Cranston.
Oh, so, yeah. I'm with you on that.
Yeah, so that's like my number one casting choice there. And yeah, it's probably because I love Breaking Bad and stuff, but it just seems to fit really well.
But you know he has reach,
one of
too.
Yeah, I mean, it would just be, I think he could, I mean, I just think that would be a perfect fit. And I had his picture sitting there. I had to find a picture that was more Malcolm in the Middle and less Breaking Bad, because all the Breaking Bad pictures are like evil.
Not
necessarily
yeah.
an evil guy. So I had to find a softer guy, softer look from Bryan Cranston to get that. Get the,
so Bryan Cranston with hair.
Yeah, you know, I could see, yeah. But every time I think I'm as bald. I'll have to check the picture. I haven't had that up in a while, see which one I got going on.
I saw some pictures of Comic-Con, and people were saying, like, there's this guy walking around with a photorealistic Walter White mask on. And it turned out...
Yeah, it was him. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. I love it.
I pray for the day that I can pull some shit like that. I would love that. Just
so,
Walter White
casting, I'm sorry.
Well, other casting choices are a little more difficult because mm-hmm. and during the initial writing of the book, I'd have one character thrown up there. And then to get a fresh look, I would throw another one. So, like, for Dale, like the main character, I was kind of, the first time around, I was going young Leo, like Basketball Diaries Leo.
Mm.
Right? And then the second time around, I was going kind of possibly shorter Andrew Garfield. So
oh, okay.
that's kind of where I was going with that. And Mac, of course, shit, who couldn't I cast as him? I could go with the first time through, I went with kind of doesn't give a shit stoner James Franco from Pineapple Express, kind of that vibe. That's what got me going on that vibe.
Is it now Dave Franco because he's the younger one, or no? Sorry.
And, yeah, sometimes I have to age shift these because, you know, I'm doing it as an actual functional thing. If somebody called me and says, hey, you get to pick the cast, like, in real life, I'd probably have to rethink a few of these. But, you know, just the actors that kind of gave me the vibe to get going with it. And where was I? I guess in the rewrite, I went with Ryan Gosling from Crazy Stupid Love.
Hmm.
I can see that.
I don't know. I might be just terrible at. I mean, I'm not a casting director for a reason. I'm just a writer guy. You know, I'm just throwing up some pictures of people I know and just let it go. And for the twins, I mean, how cliche does it get? I would just do Emma Stone. I would just. She hasn't done brunette yet. Here you go. Let's go.
See, that's super funny because I. That can be further from the image I had in my head. Of the twins.
Yeah, I could totally. Yeah, and you know what? Just because I throw a picture up doesn't mean that I describe them as the person or anything like
right.
that.
Right.
It's just kind of a vibe, I guess. And I guess the one of the craziest things about that is that Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone ended up in Spider-Man together. I was like, whoa, wait a second.
There you go.
That chemistry. Someone should have called me. I feel like copyright's been violated here. What's going on? How dare you cast these people in the same movie?
It'll be like a reunion thing.
Yeah, it'll be great. It'll be people will tune in.
Like when Kate and Leo did the Revolutionary Road.
Oh yeah.
I feel like
you've
I
got
never
something.
Mind, I don't think anybody knew what I was talking about. Go ahead.
Okay, so like I tried really hard to think about questions I could ask about the book that one wouldn't spoil anything and two wouldn't have, like, weird answers because you are reworking it.
Yeah, it's probably a tough tightrope.
Right? So are you ready for, like, probably the biggest question about your book you're ever going to have to answer?
Let's go. United, drum roll. Yes.
And now you say you're tweaking the ending, so I feel like maybe my feeling is wrong. But my thing that I kind of took away from all of this, without spoiling anything, is that this story felt like it was about how greatness, or, you know, being more than or being extraordinary isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be. Because in their own ways and at different levels, Mac and Dale were both a little bit extraordinary at different parts of their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And like you said, like, it's a pretty big downward spiral. So.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good insight, and I think that's a concept that I enjoy toying with, because one thing about Dale is he actually has a superpower, but you think to yourself, really, how when you heal slow, and it's not Wolverine healing and Wolverine strength and adamantium bones and all that shit, what kind of advantages do you really have? You have this durability to just get hurt over and over and over again, and just because he can heal, it doesn't necessarily make him great. And I think in the rewrite, what I try to do with him is for him to realize that greatness is out there and happiness is out there, and it has nothing to do with being the Samaritan. So I think that I execute that a little better in the new version. You know, because the nice thing about it is when you revisit the book as an author and it's marinated for a couple of years, you have that fresh look and you see things that you didn't see before. And there's themes that I really tried to beef up, and maybe a few things that I tried to tone back a little bit, just because they could be. Sometimes, you know, how much of an asshole does Mac have to be in the front half of the book to get the point across, you know? So I think that some of those scenes are condensed
right.
Some. But, that's a great question. That's an excellent insight. And I would say almost all of my work, especially my long-form work, I'm not a comic book guy, but I like superhero type stuff, and I like normal people who want to be something more, you know?
You know, it's super funny that you say that, because I remember this conversation we had about superheroes where you, like, totally said the opposite, because you're like, love the Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I got to defend the Man of Steel. For one thing about the Man of Steel is, I just like to be contrarian, so when a lot of people hate on the Man of Steel, I just take the totally opposite stance. I actually enjoyed it, and I think it really is difficult to pull off Superman, Man of Steel, invincibility, all that stuff. I thought they did about the best possible job that they could have. So, but yeah, I'm never going to delve into a character that is basically a god on Earth or any stuff like that. You know, I'm definitely more attracted to the human element and the character before the concept.
I think I have a good follow-up question. On your blog, you have a post that says you get to ask cool questions and do some cool stuff in the name of research, and your own reply to your own thing there is, no one says no to anything if they think it'll make it into a book. And I was trying to think of a good example, and I figured, hopefully it's not too spoilery, but in The Samaritan, it touches on organ brokerage. And
oh, yeah.
I was wondering,
yeah.
Are the prices in there, like, are those legit prices? Is that open source information on the internet, or did you actually talk to someone about it?
Well, like, there are books. There's books on organ brokerage, but you can get the prices just by calling around and saying, you know, what do cadaver parts go for? So, you know, there's that. So that was a really strange realm of research there, and I would say in that particular one you can get into some deep dark places, but there's plenty of stuff to see newspaper article wise. I remember seeing one article where some guy had his kidney jacked in another country, and how, you know, foreign people are paid just like peanuts for their kidneys so rich people can get them, and then the middlemen make all the money. So it's this whole big racket, and that got me into the whole, I mean, I know more about organ donation and how the donation system is broken, especially in this country, than I feel like I should ever know for what I put into the book. Like the chapter where Dr. Venahouse's surgery goes wrong, the research, the pages ratio on that is just astronomical. I did so much work and talked to so many people, because I know nothing about surgery, let alone getting a surgery wrong. So, yeah, I have a friend in the medical field that I ask about injuries all the time and stuff. So it's really fun.
Well, the great thing is that if writing doesn't work out, you can always go into organ brokerage since you know so much about it.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I could
there's
do that
always
job,
that.
Right?
So here's my question. I was originally just going to ask you if you were good at math, but I realize now that it's probably a better question to ask you which character you relate to more. Do you feel like you're closer to Mac or closer to Dale?
Well, my friends from around here will tell you, and I think this because it's especially because it's first person, are just going to say, "Wow, that's totally you, isn't it?" You know, and then everybody in my book, someone says, "Oh, that's totally this person that you grew up with, or totally this person." Dale is not me, of course, but I think that every single character in every single book is some version of the author. I really feel that way. I feel that if you're putting yourself in different shoes and different mindsets and stuff, there's just no way to get around it. It comes from you. So every single character is a different version of yourself. Some are more intimate than others. And Dale's a pretty intimate character for me for the simple fact that he gets hurt a lot and just keeps healing and keeps surviving. And that's something that I went through a lot as I was growing up. I was burned when I was a kid. I broke my neck. It just seems like bad luck just followed me all over the place. And no matter how bad the car wreck or no matter how bad the accident, I just kept healing up and going on. Now, it wasn't at the same level as Dale Sampson, of course.
Obviously.
But,
I feel like if you were a superhero, you'd probably have... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, crazy. So,
go on.
But the concept of healing was something that really interested me, especially in this book, because healing really does hurt. I mean, it takes a long time when you get hurt bad or you have a bad surgery to kind of get back to yourself, and it takes a toll on you every single time you bounce back.
Sure,
so,
and it itches.
And it itches, yeah.
The itch, especially with the astronomical itch of my healing burns, I'll never forget that either. So, and even though it's a public forum, since I'm married now, I can say this, but I did not have much luck with the ladies in high school, and that was something that I thought I could bring to that Dale character pretty good myself. So, that's one of the things where we relate.
Stephen Graham Jones has been a guest on the show, and he did a blurb on the original version of the book where he said he felt like it was a biography of himself. And at first I kind of didn't get it, but then listening to you talk about the injuries thing, I was like, oh, that's right, because he told us on the show, like, he's at the point in his life where if he gets hurt, his wife doesn't even take him to the hospital anymore. She just goes, okay, I'll see you later.
Constantly.
Yeah, and at one point while the book was out, he just dropped me a note about an injury that he had incurred that had healed faster than he anticipated. And it made him think of the Samaritan, which was really cool because I love him. I love his stuff. And even when I met him at it was one of the conventions. I think it was the World Horror Convention. And he was crutching around on an injured Achilles. So, yeah, definitely know that's a pretty bad injury, too. I've known a couple of friends that have had their Achilles messed up, and it's no walk in the park.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's
talking about your. Talking about your injuries, I was reading on your bio, and it says that you have 11 scars with 11 different stories. And if someone happens to be drinking a beer with you, you can tell one of those stories. I figured since we are drinking with you, maybe we could hear one of the funnier stories.
Oh, yeah.
War scars.
One of my favorite ones. I have I have kind of a jagged scar between my eyes. And it's actually been stitched up twice. The first one, and this kind of subs up, bad college decisions. We were watching wrestling. We decided to recreate something from wrestling. It did not turn out well. I was like, hell, I can make that. I can take a power bomb from a ladder through a table. That's no problem whatsoever. So that did not turn out so well. So I got a nice split between the eyes on that one. But the funnier one, I think, is, I have that stitched up and it's all healed up. We're standing around just a bonfire, drinking some beers, and somebody like holds their hand up and says, throw me a beer. So the guy throws him a beer, and it's a bottle of beer, and it just hits me right between the eyes, and I fall in the bonfire.
Wow.
So
when
I roll out of the bonfire, of course, I was like, man, I've been on fire before. I really don't want to go through this again. So I'm not actively on fire, and I'm not exactly sure if the bottle split me open or somebody split me open with their shoe or boot trying to stomp me out, like they thought I was on fire. It was all a lot of a blur, you know, and I got away with just a little second degree on the side and, you know, a few stitches between the eyes yet again. But that one, yeah, that one counts for two.
That wrestling.
We sat around long enough, I could.
That's actually the reason I don't have pierced ears to this day.
It's the reason you do what?
I don't have pierced ears.
Because
you
got
when I was in fifth grade.
Caught on fire?
No, the wrestling thing.
Oh.
When I was in fifth grade, I got my ears pierced, and then one of them accidentally got ripped out, and I was like, well, this is a lot of trouble. And then I never did that again. I let them grow up and haven't pierced them since.
Wow.
Yeah.
No piercings here. I'd probably get them caught on a semi-truck that was going by or something.
Exactly. That's why I don't do it.
So we are getting...
I don't compromise myself.
We're not exactly close on time, but I have, like, a lot of stuff on my notes left to ask you. So,
okay, go for it.
You mentioned we have talked about the Tectonic Anthology before on the show because we've had a lot of people on the show that are involved in it, and it's long time coming. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about your experiences, like when you got the email, hey, it's really happening, and tell us a little bit about the story that people can hope to find in that when they go and buy it, because they're definitely going to go and buy it.
Well, I think the story that's coming out in that one is probably one of the better stories that I've done. And the reason I feel that way is because we just talked about me being on fire. And one of the things that we had discussed in, you know, my MFA class and little friendship circles is, man, you should write about being on fire someday because you've done the research. You know what it's like. That's probably an insight that you can bring to the table. Wasn't quite ready to go with it because it was just an event. It wasn't a story. So one day I had a really, really high fever, and it was like 2:30 in the morning, and I just started writing the story, and I finished it up like at 6 in the morning and let it linger and then workshopped it, and it turned out pretty good. And when the Chuck Palahniuk thing was going down, I wasn't really an active member on those boards because I was doing my MFA, but I was like, man, I don't care about the feedback. I just want to get my hat in the ring on this. So I threw my Samaritan story in there, and I threw the story called Gasoline in there, and they both made it to Chuck for his feedback. So I got feedback from Chuck on those stories, which was great. That was like the pinnacle of my writing life at that point, when you get a sheet, you know, of Chuck telling you what he thinks of your stuff. He actually said that Gasoline was like too much of a downer. This is from Chuck Palahniuk saying this story's
too
much of a downer. So I was like, this is great. I'm not changing a damn thing. So got to that point. So once it got to that point, it's like you have two finalists there, and they're going to take the final cut from those stories. So I had like two lottery tickets in there, and Gasoline is the one that got selected for the anthology, and I didn't know if it would because it's like 6,500 words. Sometimes I think length works against you.
Yeah.
Something like that. So, really, really excited. Can't wait for it to come out. It's actually going to come out around the same time that The Heart Does Not Grow Back is going to come out next fall. So I've really got to get my shit together and prepare for next fall to do, like, actual writerly platform promotional type things that I'm not very good at.
Oh, man. Good luck.
Speaking of actually writerly platform things, you are the only person who read at our event, Books and Booze Live in St. Louis, that wasn't on the show before doing it. And thus, you are the only person that we've had on the show that I can ask this question of.
because I can't. I don't have a time machine. What was your favorite moment at Books and Booze Live in St. Louis?
Favorite moment? It has to be Keaton calling me out on the Man of Steel thing during his reading, and at the time I was ordering a drink and I totally missed the boat on it. So he totally got me on that one. So that was a great moment. But in an overall sense, it was really just great to, you know, meet you guys and meet some people that I haven't really met in person, like Brandon Teets. I have I hope I pronounce his last name correctly. I think that a lot of people might pronounce mine incorrectly, but his should be easy. But we've emailed before. We've touched base before. You know, I think we're in that same kind of circle. But I've never met the guy, so it was really exciting to meet him in person. And I just love readings. I get way too excited at reading sometimes. It's just such a joy to be there. And it's really just kind of a blessing because, you know, you grow up and you're writing these stupid little stories and you never think that you're going to be talking to agents and going to readings and people are asking you about your work. It's just totally mind-blowing. It still feels new to me, all of this. It's just crazy. So,
speaking of Brandon, he said that you punched him in the armpit. And I said I was going to ask why, but then I realized that what I really want to know is how that even happened. Like, in what situation are you in where you have access to punching somebody's armpit?
You know, I had to kind of replay these events in my head to try and figure out where I contacted and when I contacted his armpit. I can't seem to come up with it. The only thing I can come up with is when I'm happy and I've had a couple, I can be handy. Like, you know, if I'm at the softball game tonight, there's some high-fiving and stuff going on. And sometimes I give a little tap on the ribs or something like that. So maybe I was just excited, just gave him a little tap and got into the armpit. Or maybe I was just inspecting his deodorant for aluminum content to make sure that he was being safe with his deodorant choice. But I honestly can't recall the exact situation that created that. So
I love that one of the possibilities in your mind is that perhaps you were interested in what type of deodorant he used.
That could be it.
Could be.
I want people to be safe. I don't want them to use aluminum deodorant. You know, so I just inspect people left and right. Excuse me. Is there aluminum in your deodorant? Because not a good thing.
God, I don't even know. Should I be? Now
there is an aluminum.
Yeah, check your deodorant for aluminum content because that's bad for you. It gets right into your. I think your armpits are a pretty vulnerable place.
Well, I'm sure these pink fireballs aren't very good for me either, but I do.
But they'll keep you from throwing up.
But he does them. Yeah. But he pretends that he does so.
Exactly.
Well, that'll be a good question for him because he probably remembers the exact moment. Or it can at least explain what happened, you know.
We're going to have to get him back on the show just to ask him how your hand came in contact with his armpit.
Next time I give him a free one,
put that on YouTube eventually.
I'll give him that last Boy Scout shot, you know, head or gut. He gets one free shot for the armpit strike.
So, this is probably the weirdest note that I have, but it came up in the pre-show meeting.
Did it?
Benarini. What's up with that? What kind of last name is that?
Italian. Ventrini.
I was right.
I
knew
know.
It. I
yeah.
Was.
I'm like the only person on like the Ventrini side of the family that doesn't lapse into an Italian accent. My aunt for the longest time, she would just get drunk and lapse into Italian swearing. So I really don't know a ton of Italian. But and my dad is like Italy encyclopedia. Throw on the movies of Italy and the wineries back home and how the Venturinis come from the island of Ebla where Napoleon was in exile and the whole nine yards. So I've never been to Italy. I've never been there. But apparently I have a ton of family in Italy, and I can go stay at wineries and do Italian things all the time. So definitely on the bucket list. I like to go over there and be embraced in my homeland.
Literally embraced. You want hugs from the Italians.
I want hugs. I want hugs. I want wine. And he says when the young Venturinis show up at the island and the wineries and stuff, that the cousins try to get you drunk. So that's a tradition. Can't wait for that one.
These sound like the stories of my family's homeland, and we're not Italian, we're Portuguese. I feel like just people who live on islands and speak Latin-based languages just like to get drunk.
That
racist?
Could very well be the case. Yeah, I don't think that qualifies. I think everybody thinks that Latin-speaking island people drink, right? I mean, it's pretty much just a given.
Sure.
So, Jessica wants me to ask about the Bulls.
About the what?
About the Bulls, the Chicago Bulls.
The Chicago Bulls.
Oh, I forgot.
I don't know. All I remember from that conversation is that Jessica gives nicknames to the players that aren't their names, and she wanted me to ask. These are my notes. I don't know.
Well, I can talk about
the Chicago
sports team
for
as long as possible, especially the Stanley Cup champion, Chicago Blackhawks. So.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up because, as a tradition, apparently, that whenever Fred's around, we talk about hockey because I was ordered to give you a shout-out at Books and Booze live in St. Louis because your team won the game that was happening that night. So Stanley Cup
was not just – it was a huge game. It was a huge game. It was game five of the finals. Just a couple of days later, they had that 2 goals in 17 seconds. I literally almost went into shock. I was ready to tell everybody, get the shock blanket. I need to be covered up right now, just like James Brown.
just like
cover
James
me
Brown.
Up.
Exactly.
Yes, and that's kind of how it was. They scored the game-tying goal, which was a miracle, and I'm going crazy, and that's when I would get the James Brown cover-up. Like, cover, calm down, calm down. Then they score again, and I throw the cover off and just go nuts again. So
there was literally a shock blanket. That actually happened.
Yeah, and then I take my Stanley Cup pose in front of the television, and I got the champagne going, which goes back to the Bulls in the early 90s when me and my friends would watch the Jordan Bulls and we're 13 and stuff, we'd smuggle a bottle of champagne. And whenever they'd win the championship, we'd open up the champagne like the players and spray it everywhere. And that tradition still goes on. So whenever a Chicago team wins a championship, rest assured, I am somewhere popping a champagne cork.
I will now sleep easy knowing that.
And the Bulls will win the NBA championship this year. Not
it
a guarantee.
Will. You heard it here first.
Derrick Rose is intense. It's happening.
This is Books and Booze is now where you come for your sports news, people.
Yeah, hey, I can start a whole segment on sports and even some fantasy stuff. I like to gamble and shit like that. So.
Wow.
Wow.
I get a lot of weird hobbies, I guess. I don't know. I don't get too extreme with the fantasy sports, but I do like to gamble on the football games every now and again. Nothing intense, nothing leg-breaking. Just an occasional parlay if I'm feeling good on a certain weekend, you know.
So hopefully the NSA is not going to report you to your local law enforcement over that.
No, especially since I actually work for the Department of Defense. I hope they wouldn't turn me in. Like, hey,
yeah,
that kind of works for the government. Maybe we should not turn this guy in.
Yeah. I feel like when you work for the government, you're not supposed to admit to illegal things on shows that are going to be listened to literally hundreds of people.
Well, you know, there's so many federal offenses. Like one of my friends was like, here, check out this song. I downloaded it off the internet. I'm like, dude, that's a federal offense. You work for the government. What the hell are you doing? Oh, I'm sorry. It's all right. I'm actually so lazy now. I don't steal music. I just pay for it because I don't want to go looking for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there just comes a point where you're like, I'm a grown-up. I'm just going to buy the
I want. It's 99 cents. I'm going to be legit here. And the other thing I hate is whenever I downloaded a song, in the middle of it, I would always get some kid in his basement echoing, like, DJ, whatever, remixing this thing. Someone overdubbing the song. Like, get off the song. I'm trying to download a good version here. So I tried to just avoid that altogether. I just buy the song now. High fidelity, 99 cents. Love it. So
I am, like, really not counting the 4 minutes where we had that technical difficulty in the middle that I'm going to edit out. I'm out of time. I got to take care of some business. So,
okay.
once again, we are being sponsored by the book anthology. I read you the press release last week. This week, I'm going to tell you there is absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be buying that book. You got Fred. Fred's in it. A lot of familiar names, a lot of people who've been on this show have stories in it. Lots of good stuff in there. Jessica is going to be at their launch party, and hopefully she's going to take lots of embarrassing pictures that we can post on our Facebook page. No, I'm kidding. But if you do get embarrassing pictures, please post them on our Facebook page, Jessica. No. So there's nothing more fun than seeing an anthology put together by people who really love the work of the authors that are going into it. And it's a labor of love, and the book guys are good guys, so go out, order it on Amazon, click the banner. You know, maybe you have Amazon Prime and you'll get it shipped for free. I don't know what your Amazon account is like. But we are out of time. And we want to thank Fred for coming on the show. We thank him for reading it in St. Louis because he didn't know us then, and it could have been terrible. We could have been creeps. Like, who knows, right?
No, so thank you for that. Absolutely phenomenal.
And we're going to go out. We have more music from the No Tomorrow Boys. And the song we are going to listen to while you finish your drink, kick back, and think about the things you've learned here today is called Teenage Vice. And so I hope everyone has a great week. And we will be back again next week with Jason Riddler. And we're going to be talking about, like, punk rock and pro wrestling and, like, maybe Canadian military history. It's going to be a really great show.
Tomorrow is Drexville, Canada.